Thank you again for having us. I'm extremely humbled to be here. My name is Jim Busha. I'm a vice president here at EAA. I oversee publications, membership, retail, membership, and facilities. So I wear a lot of different hats, but I had the distinct honor of meeting an individual who calls Major Carpenter dad, and that's Carol Carpenter. So
thank you.
So I told Carol there'd be about maybe 10 people here to listen to our talk today. So it's amazing that this story, I've interviewed over 350 veterans in my time, mainly the World War II veterans, but one of them that I really, really had a passion for was Major Carpenter. Just because his story has been untold and of what he did. And my search ended as quickly as it began because, unfortunately, Major Carpenter passed away in 1966. So all there really was to go on was some newspaper clippings, and in essence, it became an urban legend. There wasn't anything ever really written about Major Carpenter or his airplane, only that he flew an L-4 named Rosie the Rocketeer. That all changed in 2016. I received a phone call from a young lady from Ohio who started asking me, I understand you're the editor of Warbirds, and I understand you take submissions of articles, and I'd like to write an article about my father. So this young lady started talking about her dad and just that he was a pilot. And, oh, by the way, his name was Charles Carpenter. I think Carol thought that I probably hung up on her because I was speechless for at least 30 seconds. So Carol writes this letter, which just started a big snowball. And she writes an article, and I'll let her explain that.
Well, I guess I should say that I really grew up only knowing that my dad was a hero, but I wasn't that interested in World War II or heroes. I was interested in teenage stuff. And but as I grew older, I heard a few stories, and I talked to my dad a little bit about his life and his memories of World War II, but clearly not enough. And after he died, back in the, I probably was 75 or so, I just got high-speed internet, and I went online and just typed in, by chance, Rosie the Rocketeer, just to figure out what was out there about him. And up comes all kinds of people, stories and articles, people discussing my dad. And one of the sites was the warplane site, and there was a detailed discussion about my dad, and they were saying things like, I don't think it ever happened. Let's see here what he said. Complete bollocks. I don't believe it ever happened. And I was rankled enough because I had a box when my father died. My mother left me a box of photographs and articles and clippings. So a lot of the stories, they didn't think it was possible to balance a plane and shoot it, an L-4. And so about 3 a.m, I wrote back because I had got out the articles and I started to respond. And I introduced myself. I said, I'm Carol Apaki Carpenter. My father was my father. And they went nuts. They really did, because I had the articles, and they asked. One guy said, I'm going to wipe the chicken poop off my face. I'm so embarrassed, because I sent them, showed them articles. And so that got me in the role of defending my dad, that many of these stories were true. And that's when I offered to write an article. Colin Powers was a man who had restored an L-4, and he encouraged me through Jim, introduced me to Jim, and I wrote an article, and I remember you saying, this is more than an article. This needs to be a book.
So I prodded Carol for a long time about a book, and I was very respectful of the privacy of her family, but I kept after her, and only because this story needed to be told. And finally, Carol, I believe it was in 2020, allowed me to come out to her her home in Ohio, and she kind of minimizes it a little bit, saying she had a box. So I go to her house in Ohio, and we've never met. And before me was a living room full of letters, a dining room full of letters, diaries, photographs, a kitchen table full of the same. They were scattered throughout the entire home. Carol's mother had saved every bit of paper, photographs, and diary. It was an unbelievable treasure trove. But more importantly, the very next day, she allowed me to come back. And before we began, and she said, she offered me some lemon cookies, which if you ever have any of Carol's lemon cookies, they are by far the best lemon cookies I have ever had. Carol said, Jim, I have to be honest with you. I thought you were a shyster. I thought you were here to take advantage. But so we went on this journey, and which began of the story of her father, which begins in 1912 when he was born.
Right. Well, my dad grew up a family of six. His father was a gambler, alcoholic, so my dad grew up in a small town in Illinois, Edgington, Illinois, and he grew up very poor. He told me stories of every summer the kids were farmed out to work on farms to raise money. My grandmother was a single, raising six kids on her own without a job. I don't know how they did it. And so my father didn't have an example of a father. And one of the things that I think frames his life is at 17, he wrote a creed for himself of the kind of person he wanted to be. And I'll read you that creed. This was 1929, at 17 years of age. I have resolved to exert all of my efforts toward being a nobler and stronger fellow, a gentleman, a scholar, a friend, and a real man. To the best of my ability, I will ever strive to self-control, self-improvement, freedom, wisdom, courage, generosity, truth, and true nobility before gods and men. I will be better. Charles Marston Carpenter. And I think, as I look at the story of my dad that Jim has brought to the forefront, this is framed really what you will read in the book, because during wartime, how does one hold on to these ideals? And it's a very personal story of how my dad really struggled. He may have been a hero doing brave things, but he was struggling personally, and it's, you will see this. So to me, the big question is, how does one hold on to the ideals that you are striving to achieve during wartime when you are asked to do inconceivable things? And so my dad struggled with this, and this is reflected in the letters.
And, I mean, it's really important that Charles was 17 years old when he wrote this creed. There's not many 17-year-olds today that can even write cursive, let alone put their phones down to have a creed. But Charles was set himself apart and began this journey. And I think Carol will expound on it. But he was a voracious reader, a voracious writer. He had mastered the control of the English language. And he was a Renaissance man, I believe you described him.
I'll read a passage, and very I had the unique opportunity to reflect. I am 81. I had the opportunity in my late 70s to reflect on the lives of my parents. And I had to write about it because of this book. And in the foreword, I wrote about my dad, just to give you a sense of who he was. The image of my dad as Bazooka Charlie with stories in the newspaper clippings as both mad and a legendary warrior is very different from the person I knew. Family and friends knew him as someone charismatic, highly principled, articulate, and wise. He was a man of peace, a scholar, a book collector, a poet, a practical joker, and an athlete. He loved and sang operetta in the shower and carried on serious discussions about philosophy and history. He was a devoted husband and father who patiently taught me chess, tennis, and regularly took me on nature walks and camping and canoe trips. He spent long hours with me in deep conversations about books and big ideas. He was also a highly respected high school teacher who had the school yearbook dedicated to him several times. In the summers, he ran a boys' camp in the Ozarks, a camp that focused on teaching outdoor skills and building character. I think what I'm trying to say is that his war deeds as Bazooka Charlie with Rosie the Rocketer were only a small part of who he was and the legacy he left. I really struggled whether I wanted a book written about my dad and my mom, because it's a very personal story. I think it's a love story, a complicated love story of what happens to a love and to a young and new marriage during wartime. When my father was asked to report back where the Germans were coming from, and I think the artillery followed soon after, seeing flying back over the battlefield and seeing the devastation that he had alerted the troops to. And he really struggled. And during the war, as you will see in the book, he became very cynical. He lost the ideals that I think he had struggled to try to reach because he had done things that he never dreamed that he would do. He was also unfaithful to my mother during the war. And this was a terrible, devastating reality to my mom. I don't think she knew the details. It was nothing serious. But nevertheless, she knew that the marriage was struggling too. And yet my mother held it together. Maybe I should say something about my mom.
Let's talk a little bit. Let's go back in time. Okay. In the late 1930s. Eventually, Charles gets his college education in Kentucky and becomes a high school teacher in Moline. There's a very famous dance hall near there called the Coliseum. And let's talk about how they met or almost didn't meet.
I think my mother was strikingly beautiful, but she was very lacked self-confidence. She was 28, unmarried, living in poverty, I would say. My mother wasn't educated like my father was, but everybody in Davenport, Illinois, I think went to the Coliseum if you were single and you would dance. It was a big ballroom and probably live music. And she saw this dashing young teacher over across the room, and she told her girlfriend, "Now that's somebody that I could really be attracted to. That's my idea of a man." And lo and behold, he comes over and asks her to dance. And they dance, and they have a wonderful time together. And he asks her if she would like to go out on a date. And she was so flustered and lacked such confidence that she said, "I'm sorry, I have plans with my girlfriend." And so that ended any chance of a romance, and she spent a year regretting what she had done. A year later, she's back at the Coliseum. She sees my dad again. He comes over to ask her to dance, and she said, "Do you remember me?" And of course he didn't. But this time she was better prepared. And within 3 months, they were married. My mom said, we had to get married because we were so in love that we couldn't eat. And so we had.
So it was a whirlwind romance, but unfortunately, there was storm clouds brewing in Europe at the same time. And Charles's brother, Gene, had been stationed in the Philippines. He was with the Army Air Corps. And he happened to be on Clark Field on December 8th, 1941. It would have been December 7th, 1941 at Pearl Harbor. Clark Field was devastated. Japanese attack. A few days later, 100,000 Japanese stormed the shores. And eventually, Gene was taken prisoner and became part of the Bataan Death March. During that time, Charles, who had been a reserve officer, had been called up for duty and eventually was sent to Miami to train instructors, or excuse me, train officers how to become instructors. Charles was not one to sit on the sidelines. He was a athlete in both college and high school, and he wanted to get in the big game. So he volunteered for glider training and was sent to various bases throughout the Southeast, and eventually became bored with that because of a lag time in training glider pilots. And eventually he saw a posting for liaison pilots, which he had no idea what it was, and was sent to Fort Sill, Oklahoma.
What do you want me to say about that?
So in Fort Sill, he earns his L-Wings and eventually joins, is assigned to the 3rd Army, General Patton's Army, and they're training for Europe. Eventually, he does all his training in L-3s, L-4s, like this example here that Jamie brought, and stints in L-5s. He's eventually goes back home and finds a small little care package at home, and her name is Carol.
Yes, my mother had a baby in 1942. I was born, and my dad's off in war. She sees newspaper clippings of him putting bazookas on his plane and creating quite a stir. That's all the clippings that I think Jim has read. I'll say something just about my mother, because I think this is more than a military story. I think it's a story of what war can do to families. I think it's many people's stories, even the most justified wars of World War II. Nevertheless, it's so hard and difficult on the families. My mother had a baby. She lacked the confidence that my dad had always had because of a nervous condition. She had dropped out of school in the 9th grade, and I think this lack of education had shaped her view of herself. And while she appeared to be shy and soft-spoken, my mom did have a fierceness of spirit that carried her through for 88 years. But during this time in the war, she was fragile. Me, a baby. And there is a point, and you'll see in the book, where my dad writes to her, as much as there's many love letters that are wonderful, but he said, I can never come home and be a normal person again. And you can imagine what a shock that was to my mom. I think he had seen so much, done so much, had gotten into trouble with the big brass.
So I really think what Carol's alluding to is after he leaves the deserts of California and is shipped over to England in 1944 and begins training with the 4th Armored, he's assigned an aircraft that was built by the Piper Aircraft Company in April of 1944. And it arrived in England in May of 44, and it's assigned to Major Carpenter. He eventually places, in honor of the Rosie the Rocketeers back home, the nose art of Rosie the Rocketeer. They were about to go across the channel This would have been in July of 44. The invasion had already occurred in June of 1944. So he was concerned. He has a 800-pound aircraft that's tube and fabric, unarmed. And obviously he's a little concerned about people shooting at him and his inability to shoot back. So they went to a test range in England, and they asked permission to attach a bazooka to the struts of their L-4. The officer in charge said that it was crazy. You're going to blow your tail off with the flame. And so he said that we'd like to prove it, he and his pilots. So they did, and lo and behold, it fired. There was no blowback. Tail was fine. And he asked permission from his commanding officer to attach bazookas and then use them in combat. And again, his commanding officer pled with him, saying, it's a suicide mission. You will be shot down. It won't work. Major Carpenter was not one to take no. The officer said, I'm not going to give you permission, but you're going to do what you want to do. And they did. Eventually, he attaches six bazookas to his aircraft. What Carol's alluding to about he may have gotten himself into just a really tiny, tiny, tiny bit of trouble was in early August of 44. He's in France. He's scouting a landing field. He comes across a stalled Sherman tank and some soldiers, and they're facing a very, very small French town. And at this French town, there was concealed a German 88 anti-aircraft gun. Devastating, devastating weapon. Feared by the Allies throughout the theater. And he was told by the Sherman tank crew that this town, there were hundreds of German soldiers there. Major Carpenter said, I had flown over that. It's just a resistance while the Germans are retreating. So he climbs up aboard the tank. Remember, he's a pilot. He's wearing L-wings. He's not an armored guy. climbs up on the tank. It's in the hatch. Charges the 50 caliber and says, either you guys move or I'm going to shoot you, but we're going. So he stole the tank, went forward, and lo and behold, the town was lightly defended. He did get in trouble when they rounded a corner, and he ordered the tank to fire. And unfortunately, it was another Sherman tank with a hedgerow plow blade on it, and it put a hole in the plow blade. No one was hurt. Comes back. Soldiers are cheering until their commanding officer came up and wanted to know who the hero was here. And when they found out it was a liaison pilot, he had him immediately arrested, stripped of his flight jacket, his .45 sidearm, and was told he was going to be court-martialed and probably a firing squad. So Charles Carpenter has a stirring moment and is placed in confinement in a tent and realizes that the war is ended. He's going to be embarrassed back at home if he ever makes it back home. He thinks that the lowest job he could get at the time was that of an ambulance driver, and that he embarrassed his family. And that was the last thing he wanted to do. But lo and behold, his heroics swept through the soldiers. Privates talked to corporals, corporals to sergeants, so on up the rank until his commanding officer, John Shirley Wood, found out about it and rescued him. And he became General John Shirley Wood's chief pilot and said, you will only report to me. And that's when the fire in his gut really began to boil. He was like every other soldier in Europe. They just wanted the war to end. They just wanted to go home.
I'll say that my father had great respect for General Wood. The only disadvantage of General Wood is he was, I think, close to 200 pounds.
He was over 200
pounds. 200, and would ride in the back, second seat. My dad was in the front, and they would go fly over and do reconnaissance. And so the plane would be, you know, 400 pounds of men with six bazookas in this little lightweight plane. So I think my dad writes back, this is the one thing I wish General Wood wouldn't ride with me so much, because it added a lot of
bulk. Or if he ate some more salads. So eventually,
but he had great respect for General Wood.
He had great respect, and he was a great leader of his men. So eventually, they're racing through France in 1944, and he now has six bazookas strapped to his plane. There was one mission. It was in September. It was foggy in the morning. He couldn't take off. The Germans had made an advance. They were trying to hold their line and now advancing on the Allies. They came forward. There was a crew that was stuck in a drainage ditch trying to get some water. And Major Carpenter tried to take off to help rescue them and couldn't because of the fog. Eventually, he's able to get airborne. He gets airborne. It's still kind of foggy. And he starts making runs from about 1,500 feet, starts diving down on the Germans. He did that three times that day, loaded 16 rounds of bazooka armor, lands, and was credited with not only stopping the German advance, rescuing this water crew, but also with damaging or destroying 2 to 3 tanks. What he writes home is, we just had a busy day today, and I may have hit something. That's about it. That's how he was. He did not want to scare Elda, who every letter he wrote home, he had a pet name for her, and that was Bunny.
Bunny, right. I mean, this is what my mother was living with, was this crazy husband of her doing all kinds of things that she just wanted him home. And he was clearly, I think, I'm guessing, somewhat falling apart. And this is the reality, I think, of what he was seeing every day. As you know, General Wood was eventually, I think, fired by General Patton because he was what needed rest and recuperation. It was, and I think it, what I've heard, this sweep across the 4th Armored Division across France was one of the most effective fighting forces in history. They really pushed the Germans back basically over a summer and a fall.
Yeah, and that was in December of 44. General Wood was relieved of his command. General Wood's stance was his men come first. He was an individual that slept in a tent, slept on muddy ground, while other officers were in train cars and chalets. He was a true leader of men and stood up for his men and may have said a little too much. He was actually great friends with General Patton, but General Patton had no other recourse but to relieve his friend of duty and send him home. So this is the buildup now into the Battle of the Bulge, and Charles is part of that. Suddenly, he develops a sore neck. And this is now towards early January of 1945. And he sees the field doctor, and he's still flying, still firing his bazooka, still fighting. But he says to the doctor, it's just a little sore. Doctor sees a small lump and says, I'm sending you back to Paris just to get it checked out. Well, the doctors in Paris examine him. They take a small biopsy, and they determine that he has Hodgkin's lymphoma. And they tell him, you have 2 years to live.
Right. So this is the way he came back to my mother, told he had 2 years to live. My mother was this is where I, in reflection, I realize what a hero my mother was too. And this is what I think is part of the story. A hero always has backup. My mother had to deal with a husband that's dying, a financial crisis, a baby. And so what my father wanted to do was sell the house and take a trip and go out west before he had never seen the beauties of the West. And so my mother agreed that we bought a Silver Stream, I think, a trailer, and we, for a year, we traveled out west and saw the wonders of the western part of the country. And then my father expected to come back and die. But actually, he was feeling pretty good by the time he came back. And so he took a temporary job as the interim commandant of a military school where he had gone to high school for a couple of years, or college, was
the
it college?
Roosevelt Military Academy.
Yeah, Roosevelt Academy. Military Academy. Worked there for a year and still is feeling pretty good. So always having surgery every year as these nodes on the lymph glands would swell up. And so I am dealing as a spoiled four-year-old with a dying father who was quite stern. He had high expectations for me. Just to give you a sense, I remember the first Christmas my dad was home. I had a pile of presents, and I ripped through them, threw the gifts away, and acted, I guess, kind of like a spoiled brat, and my dad just exploded. He was just the thought of a daughter that was so spoiled. He had seen such suffering in Europe. So that's the way my life was as a young girl growing up in early years. My dad was very stern with me, and my mother was soft and gentle. And so this was it took a while for our relationship to build. But as I got older, my dad was determined that I wasn't going to be a fraidy cat. I remember seeing a snake in the yard, and he had me go pick it up and hold it up. I still have that picture. I think it was 5, and the snake is swinging over, and I get the picture, and then I faint. We got on a swimming. He took me to swimming regularly, and when he wanted me to try diving on the 30-foot diving board. I was probably 10 at this point, and he's down below, and he wants me to jump. He didn't want me to be a fearful child, and I can still remember hovering over the diving board and my dad yelling, "Jump, damn it, jump!" So I did. But so my dad was always pushing me to be brave, to not be fearful. He took me camping. Meanwhile, he is diagnosed and struggling with Hodgkin's disease. So it was like a shadow on our lives, and this is the way my mother was having to deal with our lives. Very uncertain.
And death followed your dad for a long, long time, but he kept 10 paces in front of it. Let's just pause on your father for just a minute.
Okay.
So in 2016, Carol writes this article. It gets published in EA Warbirds magazine in 2017. And there's a gentleman who became a friend of ours, Joe Scheel, out in California. And Joe's an airline pilot, has a Stearman, has a Piper Cub. And Joe, for fun, likes to look up serial numbers. So Joe looks at the serial number of the picture in the magazine of Rosie the Rocketeer. And to his amazement, the aircraft is actually hanging in a museum in Austria. Joe is best friends with Rob Collings of the Collings Foundation. So Joe contacts Rob. Rob had been looking for a proven combat aircraft from the European theater. None, obviously, were for sale. Many in the Smithsonian or in private museums or collections. This one, however, was hanging in Austria. The history of it was Major Carpenter is sent home in February of 45. The airplane is obviously assigned to another pilot. The war in Europe ends in May of 45. And so it was much cheaper for the Allies to leave these aircraft behind than to try to ship them home. They were worthless to them. So everyone thought it would have been scrapped, burned, torn up. Nope. An Austrian glider club bought the airplane and then converted it to a 90-horse engine, put some Super Cub gear on it and a tow hook, and used it to tow gliders. They had no idea the historic artifact they had. So when Rob goes over there and talks to them, they were a little confused on why this American would come over and want this ratty old cub hanging in their museum. And Rob just says, I've just got an affliction for cubs. I really want it. And
he asked me to write a letter, too.
And eventually he strikes a deal, and he sends the cub back home. And that was in 2019. It arrived in Colin Power's shop out in Oregon. And Colin had restored numerous award-winning L4s before. And so when Rob and Colin peeled back the ratty yellow fabric, that's they had repainted it, there, lo and behold, were battle-damaged scars that Major Carpenter had written home about, including one where he said he had a kind of a hairy day. He was dodging some German fire, hit a church steeple with his right tire, and then may have caught a little round in the wing. Well, they looked at that round. They put a wooden dowel through it to see where it would have, if it had continued and not lodged in the wing, where it would have exited. And it would have missed the back of his head by this much. So, again, he encountered this every single day. Every single day. So eventually, the airplane is restored. The spirit of Rosie is here. We wanted it here. Rob ran into some conflicts. But you have a live Carol Carpenter here, which is the cherry on top as far as I'm concerned. So eventually, in the early 60s, your dad wants to turn boys into men.
He carried that theme of the creed that I read to you at 17. I just want to say the story of my mom and dad has a happy ending. They came home. When my dad came home, they restored their marriage. My mother was determined I was going to grow up with a father. And through that love and forgiveness and seeing it through, I grew up with a wonderful father. So I think that's yes. The happy ending. And I think that's what I hope the book communicates, that lives are complicated. Even in wartime, it's exaggerated, but people do move on. I'm sure my dad had PTSD when he came home. I don't think there was a name for it. But he recovered, and he had a second half of his life with a terminal illness that he was a beloved teacher. He ran a boys' camp in the summer with a creed of creating, turning boys into men down in Bay Nothing in southern Missouri on the Current River. And it was he led a rich and fulfilling life. I went into the Peace Corps, and one day I get a call that my father was dying. And I was sent home, and I spent 2 months with him as he's in the hospital and finally dies at 53. My mother carried on and lived till she was 88 and died rather on the day of my father's birthday. So I'd like to think of it as my mother. I had just brought her soup the day before, and when I went to check her the next day, she was lying on the floor, and she had died, had gone. Well, let me just read you, because I think it's a tribute to my mom. She held my grandchildren, her great-grandchildren, and she stood on the porch and we waved goodbye. And I said to my daughter, "Doesn't Grandma look beautiful?" The next day, I found her lying on the bedroom floor. She had passed away on my father's birthday. I like to picture my father coming for her with outstretched hands and saying, "Bunny, it's time to come home." There were still some strawberries that my mother had served the day before, left in the refrigerator, and all of the boxes of newspaper clippings and diaries and poetry that my dad had written. And so who would have thought this amazing story that 60 years later, the plane is found, restored. Colin Powers, I want to say he's watching somewhere in Washington, who restored the plane and was such a model for me of grace and ingenuity, and he restored my dad's plane with such love and care. He invited my daughter, who's a graphic designer, to come and do the nose art for Rosie the Rocketer. Perfectly done. Put my picture and my mother's picture on the engine of the plane, and Rosie lives again. She flew. There's pictures of her on YouTube. And I guess the mystery for me is, this was a long time ago. This is one person's story. But there's something, if you go on YouTube, there's like 6 animations, there's many war sites about my dad. And what I'd like to ask of Jim is, what makes this such a compelling story to so many people? This was so long ago. There were many heroes of World War II. We know that there are.
I really feel that for so long, before we met, obviously, your father was an urban legend. My friend Adam Makos, who's a well-known author, said there's a freak factor with what he did. I mean, they called him the Mad Major. To you, he wasn't, but he strapped 6 bazookas to a fabric-covered airplane, and he tirelessly attacked German armor on almost a daily basis. So the only thing ever written about him were some newspaper articles, and they were kind of vague, obviously. They couldn't give you the full details during the war. There was a censorship. And so, again, I really feel as though if your father had been alive and I had asked to interview him, like many, many of that generation, he would have held up his hand and said, "No, thank you. I just did my job."
So I think it's everybody's story. That's what I hope the book communicates.
So let's talk to Jamie about his airplane. We've got a couple minutes, and we'll just take just a few. To come on up, Jamie, and just tell us about your L4 that you brought over.
Test. It's on.
So go ahead. Tell us about your aircraft. What model is it?
Okay, this is a model L-4B. It was built in 1943. My understanding is the yellow tail number.
We're going to look at the camera over here.
This one, okay. That the yellow tail number represents 43, the 3 on the back there, and that was the 1,257th airplane delivered that year.
What is it like? What's it like to fly an 800-pound airplane? Could you see yourself strapping 6 bazookas to that and attacking German tanks?
Sounds like fun.
Yeah, but you got people shooting at
you.
Yeah,
no, and it's dangerous. It would be you would definitely feel like a target all the time. I mean, it would, because you're low, you're in small arms range, just like you were talking about the bullet that passed through. And everybody shooting at you.
And what is your cruise speed on this?
70 miles per hour.
70 miles an hour.
Yeah.
So you're a very slow moving target.
Yeah, you could firewall it and do almost 80, and then you're out of gas in an hour and a half.
Okay, yeah. Almost 80. My wife drives a lot faster than that on the highway. So
yeah.
What about the paint scheme? What does it represent?
This would be a representative of European theater. Don't know what the 25 and the K, if it's a specific unit
okay.
or whatever, but it is representative of European theater. You got the invasion stripes so that you don't get shot down by your own people. You know, that's what those are for.
And you've got some period radios in the back, and along with it looks like a trailing antenna maybe?
Yep, you got the antenna on the little reel, which went through the little hole in the tail, and they could reel that out, let it drag out behind, and then you could transmit.
Okay.
Friendlies.
All right. Thank you very much. So I think we're going to take any questions from the crowd now for Carol or myself. Is there someone with a microphone that can... Who's got the microphone?
Carol, did you ever go flying with your dad?
I never did. No. I only have ridden on Ozark Airlines as a kid.
Would you like to go up in an L4?
I would love to. I can't imagine. I was stunned when I saw my dad's plane for the first time.
What part of Ohio do you live in?
I live in near Columbus in Granville, Ohio.
You know where the Hocking Hills are?
Oh, my goodness, yes.
We have an L4 down there, and it's got an empty seat for you.
Oh, how nice.
Thank you. Thank you.
Jim, Jim and Carol, thank you. Carol, thanks for letting him have the letters to write the book. I've read the book. It's a really good book. I've read 17 World War II books in the last 4 years, and I would definitely put it among the top three because I had a couple other favorites, but it's far and above average. Carol, it's obvious you got your mother's looks. I know you've commented on how, when you said how old you were, I hadn't done the math, and I said, holy crap. But I would like to ask you, Jim, you did a great job of taking the letters she provided and putting them into the right places so that you really felt attached to the Charlie Carpenter. This is sort of a weird question, but L5-wise, as you and I know, there was a Marine pilot in the spring of 45 who decided he would try bazookas on the L5, I think in Okinawa, and he was actually here at Oshkosh about 12 years ago. He's passed away now. And I was wondering if you think he saw the Stars and Stripes article in the winter time frame of what Charlie was doing and said, hell, if a Army guy can do it, a Marine can do it.
So the individual you're talking about is Tom Rozga, and I had the honor of interviewing him. So we did discuss that. And he did, in fact, know that Carpenter had done this in Europe. And Tom had the L5, a little bigger, a little higher performance than the L4, and again, had the same problems convincing his commanding officer that he could, in fact, do that. But Tom did it very successfully. Tom's great achievement was he was actually the second aircraft to land on Okinawa. And again, Okinawa was heavily defended by the Japanese. So he's landing on this coral rocky bed, cutout runway, as the Marines are still coming ashore while the Japanese are firing from above. But Tom used those bazookas quite successfully to eradicate Japanese hidden on that island. Yes.
I'll just add, while it occurs, one of the reasons I was willing to write this book is because I have 13 grandchildren. Four of them are here, and they
are... Why don't you guys stand up? Where are you?
Yeah.
And look at their hats. Look what they're wearing.
And they are hearing their grandfather's story in a way that I never dreamed would happen. And this is really... To me, this is the reason, thanks to Jim, why I have done this. It's a wonderful story. It's an inspiring story, I feel. It's a complicated story, but I hope this next generation can feel proud of their great-grandfather and carry on.
Thank you all very much. And please come over to the gift shop and